numerous incidents of sadistic, blatant, and wanton abuses were inflicted on several detainees. This systematic and illegal abuse of detainees was intentionally perpetrated by several members of the Military Police Guard force. I was shaken by what I learned. The guards' behavior exhibited a degree of perversion and glee in the sexual degradation of prisoners that I didn't want to believe American soldiers were capable of. The North Vietnamese could be cruel and would inflict pain to get what they wanted from us, but they never did anything like this, and the thought of that my captors had, on the whole, treated prisoners more humanely than the American soldiers at Abu Ghraib treated prisoners made me sick to my stomach. The Senate Armed Services Committee convened a hearing on the scandal on May 7, 2004. Secretary Rumsfeld was called as a witness, as was the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Chief of Staff of the Army, the Acting Secretary of the Army, the Deputy Commander of the Central Command, CENTCOM, and the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence. I had prepared what I thought was a straightforward question for Rumsfeld. I wanted him to explain the chain of command from the prison guards to the top military and civilian authorities. I wanted to know who supervised interrogations at Abu Ghraib and what instructions they had given the guards there. Rumsfeld answered that he ordered a chart prepared outlining the chain of command, but that his aides had neglected to bring it. General Lance Smith, the deputy CENTCOM commander, volunteered to walk me through the chain of command. I interrupted him and told him to submit it for the record, and asked, "What agency or private contractor was in charge of the interrogations? Did they have authority over the guards? And what were the instructions that they gave to the guards?" Some hemming and hawing ensued, some continued lamenting of the missing chain of command chart, when Committee Chairman John Warner referred my question to General Smith. "No," I interjected. "Secretary Rumsfeld, with all due respect, you've got to answer this question, and it could be satisfied with a phone call. This is a pretty simple, straightforward question. What agencies or private contractors were in charge of the interrogations? And what were their instructions to the guards? This goes to the heart of the matter." What I wanted to know, as was apparent to the witnesses, was whether the sadistic behavior of the guards had been influenced by instructions from, or the example set by the people interrogating detainees at Abu Ghraib. Again, General Smith intervened, and after a little back and forth, informed the committee that the commander of the Military Intelligence Brigade had authority over the interrogators and tactical control over the guards. I asked Secretary Rumsfeld why he couldn't answer these fundamental questions. When I pressed him on the instructions the guards had received, he punted, referring the matter to an ongoing investigation. When I reminded him again that it was a simple question he ought to be prepared to answer, he allowed that the guards had been instructed to adhere to the Geneva Conventions. In the weeks after my questioning of Rumsfeld, which had been televised, my staff received a number of cold calls from people with knowledge of detainee interrogations, warning us that bad things were happening. Frequent revelations in the press that year exposed abuses at prisons other than Abu Ghraib, at the Salt Pit, and at the Bagram Air Base prison in Afghanistan, where men were heard crying all night long. We heard stories about prisoners killed by interrogators because the interrogators were inexperienced and insufficiently trained and supervised. One Iraqi had suffocated to death when his interrogators had put him in a sleeping bag, zipped it over his head, and rolled him back and forth repeatedly. One of the interrogators had a brother who had done the same to him, and he thought it would be a good way to get the prisoner to talk. My foreign policy assistant at the time, Richard Fontaine, had previously worked at the National Security Council. He told me about the Black Site Rendition Program. In November 2005, the Washington Post would report the existence of these black sites in a story that would win a Pulitzer. Someone leaked a memo from Rumsfeld concerning interrogations at the Guantanamo detention facility, complaining that prisoners were only made to stand up for 8 hours. Rumsfeld, who worked at a standing desk, observed that he stood up longer than that. Interrogation logs from Guantanamo also leaked and revealed that one prisoner hadn't slept more than 3 hours in a single night for several months. The interrogators had made him do dog tricks. Some of the dubious legal assertions proposed in the torture memos were leaked to the press in the wake of the Abu Ghraib scandal. Jack Goldsmith, a distinguished law school professor who had previously worked in the Defense Department, succeeded J. Bybee as head of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel. To much consternation in some White House offices, he rescinded the torture memos and began working on a revised legal opinion, believing the former were flawed legal analyses that appeared to give official sanction to torture and brought such dishonor on the United States. He resigned his office after just 10 months before he had finished writing a revised legal opinion, in part because of the distrust he was held in by senior administration officials. With all these stories breaking about black site renditions and prisoner abuse, torture memos, and although still a little murky, increasing reports of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques used by the CIA, it was clear that a problem the administration had blamed on a bunch of undisciplined knuckleheads at Abu Ghraib was more systemic than that and might be the product of a deliberate policy. I was already considering how Congress could ensure that core American values and our responsibilities under the Geneva Conventions were upheld in our treatment of all detainees. The undertaking acquired greater urgency after I received a letter from an Army officer, Captain Ian Fishback, confirming our suspicions. Ian Fishback, a West Point graduate and a veteran of combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan with the 82nd Airborne Division, had conveyed reports about prisoner abuse by soldiers in the 82nd to his chain of command, and been mostly ignored. After nearly a year and a half waiting for a sign that the Army was taking his concerns seriously, and having seen my exchange with Rumsfeld at the Abu Ghraib hearing, he wrote a letter to me. He contacted Tom Malinowski at Human Rights Watch, as did two sergeants in his former battalion. Tom put him in touch with Richard Fontaine, to whom he had sent a letter addressed to me. It was a sincere, convincing, and distressing appeal from a professional soldier who believed the honor of his service and his country was being stained. It's worth retelling here in full. Dear Senator McCain, I am a graduate of West Point, currently serving as a captain in the U.S. Army Infantry. I have served 2 combat tours with the 82nd Airborne Division, one each in Afghanistan and Iraq. While I served in the global war on terror, the actions and statements of my leadership led me to believe that United States policy did not require application of the Geneva Conventions in Afghanistan or Iraq. On 7 May 2004, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld's testimony that the United States followed the Geneva Conventions in Iraq and the spirit of the Geneva Conventions in Afghanistan prompted me to begin an approach for clarification. For 17 months, I tried to determine what specific standards governed the treatment of detainees by consulting my chain of command through battalion commander, multiple JAG lawyers, multiple Democrat and Republican congressmen and their aides, the Fort Bragg Inspector General's office, multiple government reports, the Secretary of the Army, and multiple general officers, a professional interrogator at Guantanamo Bay, the deputy head of the department at West Point, responsible for teaching just war theory and law of land warfare, and numerous peers who I regard as honorable and intelligent men. Instead of resolving my concerns, the approach for clarification process leaves me deeply troubled. Despite my efforts, I have been unable to get clear, consistent answers from my leadership about what constitutes lawful and humane treatment of detainees. I am certain that this confusion contributed to a wide range of abuses, including death threats, beatings, broken bones, murder, exposure to elements, extreme forced physical exertion, hostage-taking, stripping, sleep deprivation, and degrading treatment. I and troops under my command witnessed some of these abuses in both Afghanistan and Iraq. This is a tragedy. I can remember as a cadet at West Point, resolving to ensure that my men would never commit a dishonorable act, that I would protect them from that type of burden. It absolutely breaks my heart that I have failed some of them in this regard. That is in the past, and there's nothing we can do about it now. But we can learn from our mistakes and ensure that this does not happen again. Take a major step in that direction. Eliminate the confusion. My approach for clarification provides clear evidence that confusion over standards was a major contributor to the prisoner abuse. We owe our soldiers better than this. Give them a clear standard that is in accordance with the bedrock principles of our nation. Some do not see the need for this work. Some argue that since our actions are not as horrifying as Al-Qaeda's, we should not be concerned. When did Al-Qaeda become any type of standard by which we measure the morality of the United States? We are America, and our actions should be held to a higher standard. The ideals expressed in documents such as the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Others argue that clear standards will limit the president's ability to wage the war on terror. Since clear standards only limit interrogation techniques, it is reasonable for me to assume that supporters of this argument desire to use coercion to acquire information from detainees. This is morally inconsistent with the Constitution and justice in war. It is unacceptable. Both of these arguments stem from the larger question, the most important question, that this generation will answer. Do we sacrifice our ideals in order to preserve security? Terrorism inspires fear and suppresses ideals like freedom and individual rights. Overcoming the fear posed by terrorist threats is a tremendous test of our courage. Will we confront danger and adversity in order to preserve our ideals? Or will our courage and commitment to individual rights wither at the prospect of sacrifice? My response is simple. If we abandon our ideals in the face of adversity and aggression, then those ideals were never really in our possession. I would rather die fighting than give up even the smallest part of the idea that is America. Once again, I strongly urge you to do justice to your men and women in uniform. Give them clear standards of conduct that reflect the ideals they risk their lives for. With the utmost respect, Captain Ian Fishback, 1st Battalion, 504th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 82nd Airborne Division, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I would rather die fighting than give up the smallest part of the idea that is America. If there is a finer declaration of an American soldier's duty and sense of honor, I haven't heard it. I met with Captain Fishback and was as impressed with his genuineness and professionalism in person as I had been with the qualities evident in his letter. I assured him he was right to have reached outside his chain of command to bring his legitimate concerns to responsible public officials, and that I and the others in Congress were already working to make sure that, as he affirmed, the United States would confront danger and adversity in order to preserve our ideals. Our first effort to do just that was the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005, which Senator Warner and Lindsey Graham and I offered to that year's Defense Appropriations Bill. It had two main provisions. First, that interrogations of detainees by U.S. military or civilian Defense Department officials must adhere to the strict guidance for treating enemy prisoners provided in the Army Field Manual. Second, that all other agencies of the federal government, including the CIA, are prohibited from the cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of any prisoner, regardless of nationality or physical location. White House opposition to the resolution was initially fierce, spearheaded by the Vice President and his staff, and the new CIA director, Porter Goss. Before they had seen the text of the resolution, the administration had put out a statement opposing it. Cheney and Goss came to see me in a secure room in the Capitol and laid out what they claimed was valuable intelligence obtained through enhanced interrogation techniques that had prevented new terrorist attacks. They walked me through the techniques, downplaying their actual severity. At one point, we got in a back-and-forth over sleep deprivation. "How long are you keeping them awake?" I asked. They eventually acknowledged that some detainees had been deprived of sleep for as much as 120 hours. "I had a friend, a Marine, who was kept awake for a week," I observed. "It almost killed him." They also intimated that if our resolution passed, the techniques would be discontinued, and I would have American blood on my hands. That was a misjudgment on their part. All their crude attempt to shame me did was anger me, make me deeply suspicious about the credit they were giving torture. I knew from personal experience that every man has his breaking point and would yield to torture at some point. But I knew, too, that information extracted by torture is unreliable. You say anything to make it stop, true, false, or just fed to you by your torturers. An aide to the Vice President, David Addington, handed me an amendment to the resolution he had prepared that would have excluded the CIA from the prohibition against cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. That would have been worse than doing nothing. There were additional meetings with Vice President Cheney and his staff for the Republican senators supporting our resolution. A few got wobbly, but only 9 Republican senators ended up opposing it. We also discouraged Senate Democrats, all of whom supported the resolution, from formally co-sponsoring it. We wanted the effort to be seen as a revolt of Republican hawks, which we believed would have a greater restraining impact on the administration. The lobbying by the Vice President and associates was persistent and intense, and it provoked unflattering attention on the editorial pages of the nation's newspapers. Eventually, in a sign that the President wanted the matter resolved, his National Security Advisor, Steve Hadley, contacted us. Richard Fontaine had once worked for Hadley, and he advised me that when Hadley took the lead in negotiations, it was an indication the President wants a deal. The discussions dragged on a few more weeks. We eventually agreed to some fairly minor language changes that left the major provisions intact. In the end, the resolution passed the Senate by 90-9. After the President signed the underlying bill into law, the White House released a statement that the President, as Commander-in-Chief, would construe the detainees' protections consistent with his duty to protect the American people from further terrorist attacks. In other words, administration officials refused to acknowledge that they were absolutely bound by the prohibitions. We would have to find another way to convince them they were. An opportunity to do so was presented by the Supreme Court's decision in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, which found, among other things, that Common Article 3 applied to our treatment of Al-Qaeda prisoners and that their detention must comply with the Geneva Conventions. The administration determined that the only way around the decision's ramifications for the legality of the EITs was to water down the meaning of Common Article 3, an idea that was, to say the least, abhorrent to me. They proposed to weaken the article's protections so they could continue abusive interrogations and still claim they were legal. The notion that abuse that included waterboarding was permitted by the Geneva Conventions was as bizarre as it was unacceptable. I was worried that Congress, needing to act in response to the Hamdan decision, would go along with the administration's wishes, so I was willing to talk. Initially, our discussions were focused on using military commissions to adjudicate the cases of detainees held at Guantanamo. During the course of examining the bill language they proposed, we noticed the changes to Common Article 3. Fontaine conveyed my objections to the NSC and a succession of high-profile officials, including DCI Mike Hayden, NSA Steve Hadley, and the new head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, Stephen Bradbury, who had been involved in preparing parts of the torture memos, were dispatched to change my mind. It was clear that Hayden wanted legal cover from justice that would allow the continued use of the EITs and, perhaps more important, that protected the CIA from legal jeopardy for their past use. Bradbury was willing to provide it, but only if Congress gave him cover. Hadley wanted to find a deal. Efforts were made again to persuade me that the EITs, including waterboarding, were not torture. They included a briefing with a young officer who had waterboarded detainees and assured me it was done safely and did not do lasting harm to the victims. Hayden and company met with my staff, too, namely Fontaine and Salter, who weren't persuaded, and explained that it wouldn't matter if they were because I was unmovable. Eventually, we began negotiating provisions of what would become the Military Commissions Act of 2006. Lindsay, an Air Force Reserve lawyer, and my Arizona colleague John Kyle took the lead on working out the terms of the military commissions. I focused on protecting the Geneva Conventions. Our bottom line demand was that the clear intent of the conventions could not be altered, and that any language we agreed to must have the effect of prohibiting the continued use of waterboarding and other extreme practices. After weeks of talks, we reached a compromise. There are two kinds of breaches of Common Article 3, grave and non-grave. Grave breaches are prosecutable under the war crime statute. Non-grave breaches are not prosecutable as war crimes. The administration position was that the article was vague on what constituted grave and non-grave breaches. They wanted the president to proclaim those definitions. Eventually, we agreed to let the president enumerate non-grave breaches so long as the standards he promulgated were higher than those that currently existed. To my regret, the administration did not adhere to the clear intent of the agreement. They never enumerated non-grave breaches or established higher standards. Grave breaches were already enumerated in the War Crimes Act of 1996, and it was there that I wanted to restrict the administration from resuming the worst abuses. In fairness, the administration had not, to my knowledge, waterboarded another detainee since passage of the Detainee Treatment Act the year before, and had refrained from some of the other techniques as well, believing, I assume, that they would likely violate the Act's prohibitions. Still, no one in authority had ever conceded that waterboarding or any other interrogation technique was torture, and thus prohibited, and I wanted more certainty that the CIA would not resort to using such techniques in the future. In the last week of September 2006, Salter, Fontaine, and I joined in marathon negotiating sessions with administration officials, including Hadley and Bradbury, in a hearing room in the Dirksen Senate office building. Having agreed to allow the president to enumerate non-grave breaches, we searched for a way to define grave breaches that would prevent the resumption of waterboarding and other abuses. The solution we arrived at involved amending the War Crimes Act of 1996 to define 9 offenses that constituted grave breaches of Common Article 3, prosecutable as war crimes and punishable by imprisonment or death. The first offense was torture. The second, cruel and inhuman treatment. Torture included acts that were intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain and suffering. The prohibition against cruel and inhuman treatment added the descriptor serious to physical and mental suffering. Serious mental pain and suffering was defined in the Act as prolonged. That adjective was easy to exploit, as the authors of the torture memos had, interpreting it to mean months and years of suffering. They had used its vagueness to allow waterboarding. I asked Hadley and Bradbury to remove the word from the definition and recommended a substitute, non-transitory. And lest that be interpreted as synonymous with prolonged, we added in parentheses, which need not be prolonged. They said they could accept the former, but not the latter. We insisted, and eventually they acquiesced, but only if we agreed that the new definition would not be retroactive, that it would apply only to conduct after the bill's date of enactment. The reason was obvious. They felt the new definition of cruel and inhuman treatment made waterboarding and likely some of the other EITs prosecutable as war crimes. With that in mind, I asked Bradbury if he believed the new definition would prohibit waterboarding in the future. He answered that he believed it would. Hadley concurred, and although neither man nor anyone else in the administration ever acknowledged publicly that the revised statute made waterboarding a war crime, I am confident that it did, and so were they. The practice was not used again. I believed that whatever protection from legal jeopardy the date of enactment condition gave the agency was acceptable in exchange for preventing the resumption of the worst practices. Throughout our negotiations with the administration, we kept in close touch with Tom Malinowski at Human Rights Watch and Elisa Massimino, the president of Human Rights First. We had good working relationships with both of them based on mutual trust. The human rights community, including Tom's and Elisa's organizations, opposed the Military Commissions Act, although their biggest objection to the bill was the denial of habeas corpus and the provisions establishing the commissions, which I had not been involved in negotiating. The critics had a point, as was evidenced by the Supreme Court's 2008 decision in Boumediene v. Bush, which held that the suspension of habeas was unconstitutional. Their principal concerns with our efforts were our agreement that the Bush administration could define non-grave breaches of Common Article 3, and that our revisions to the War Crimes Act weren't retroactive, making the use of EITs before the MCA harder to prosecute. Despite those concerns, I think Tom and Elisa recognized we had prevented the Geneva Conventions from being weakened and had imposed a formidable legal obstacle to the worst interrogation practices. The MCA passed both houses of Congress easily, but without much Democratic support and to little applause and a fair amount of criticism. In July of 2007, President Bush signed an executive order that instead of establishing higher standards for non-grave breaches, stated that the CIA's detention and interrogation program fully complies with the obligations of the United States under Common Article 3. That was predictable, critics in the human rights community argued. Perhaps so. In December of that year, the New York Times reported that tape recordings of CIA interrogations had been destroyed on Jose Rodriguez's order. That too angered me and eroded further my already diminished store of trust in the good faith of the agency's leadership. Nevertheless, I believed I had achieved what I had set out to achieve, protecting the Geneva Conventions and stopping waterboarding, and I honored my end of the bargain by not restricting the CIA interrogations more than I already had. In February of 2008, I voted against a Senate resolution that President Bush had promised to veto, which would have limited CIA interrogators to the practices approved in the Army Field Manual. I received a fair amount of abuse in the editorial pages for that vote, and from human rights advocates, even some with whom I worked closely. I was the front-runner for the Republican presidential nomination at the time of the vote, which drew a bigger crowd of Democratic critics than it normally would have. But on this issue, I don't need any more approval than a quiet conscience. With the death of Osama bin Laden in May 2011, came fresh reminders that the torture debate had not ended. As long as serious men and women argued for torture's efficacy, the United States would be at risk of staining our honor again by resorting to the abuses that our enemies could use to encourage mistrust of our leadership and cynicism about our values. In one of his first acts as president, Barack Obama rescinded President Bush's executive order claiming the CIA had acted in full compliance with Common Article 3, and he withdrew the agency's authority to hold detainees and restricted their interrogations to those approved in the Army Field Manual. He and his Attorney General Eric Holder would eventually decide not to prosecute interrogation abuses during his predecessor's administration. But when bin Laden finally met the fate he deserved, the apologist for torture appeared in numbers on cable news shows and in the newspapers claiming bin Laden wouldn't have been found without intelligence gained through the use of EITs. Article number one in their reinvigorated apologia was information coerced from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed after he was waterboarded repeatedly. No less an authority than former Attorney General Michael Mukasey stepped forward to claim in the Wall Street Journal that the intelligence that led to bin Laden began with a disclosure from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who broke like a dam under the pressure of harsh interrogation techniques that included waterboarding. He loosed a torrent of information, including eventually the nickname of a trusted courier of bin Laden. Virtually nothing in that statement is true, but as angered as I was at the time by Mukasey's disingenuousness, I would learn later that he wasn't entirely to blame. CIA officials had misled him, as they had other justice officials, and as it turns out, as they misled senior White House officials, including President Bush and Vice President Cheney. The first mention of bin Laden's courier's pseudonym, Abu Akbed al-Kuwaiti, came from a detainee held in another country who was not waterboarded or otherwise tortured and who identified Kuwaiti as an important figure in al-Qaeda. When interrogators confronted KSM with the name, he claimed Kuwaiti was an active in al-Qaeda, had married, and had moved to Peshawar in Pakistan, none of which was true. The best intelligence on Kuwaiti's real role in al-Qaeda and his relationship to bin Laden came to us from a detainee who was questioned using standard, non-coercive means by interrogators who had done the most essential thing in questioning a suspect. They had gained his trust. In truth, most of the CIA's claims that abusive interrogations of detainees had produced vital leads to help locate bin Laden were exaggerated, misleading, and in some cases, complete bullshit. We would learn the truth from the same investigation that revealed how the CIA had misled Bush administration officials. We learned it from the persistent, scrupulous, determined investigation of the CIA's use of enhanced interrogation techniques by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, chaired by Senator Dianne Feinstein. Begun early in 2009, partly out of concern that Jose Rodriguez's destruction of interrogation video recordings might be part of an effort to cover up the unlawful torture of detainees, the investigation would examine millions of emails, cables, communiques, and other documents related to the CIA's detention and interrogation program between the years 2001 and 2006. After 2006, the agency was believed to have stopped using most of the techniques in question. After nearly 4 years, tens of millions of dollars, countless man-hours of dogged inquiry, examination, and analyses, unexpected good luck, a lack of bipartisan cooperation, an attempt by the agency to spy on committee investigators, the committee approved a 6,000-page report almost on a strict party-line vote, with Susan Collins, the only Republican, voting with the committee majority. 2 years later, over the furious objections of the CIA and senior officials in the Obama administration, the committee publicly released a 525-page unclassified, overly redacted, meticulously footnoted, and damning summary. The following are some of its findings. The CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques were ineffective at acquiring good intelligence. Interrogations of detainees were much more brutal than the agency had acknowledged. Some detainees were subjected to abuses not authorized by CIA leadership or the Justice Department. The CIA made inaccurate claims for the effectiveness of the techniques. It misled the Department of Justice and other executive branch offices. It impeded congressional oversight, the CIA Inspector General's investigation, and White House oversight and decision-making. DCI's George Tenet, Porter Goss, and Michael Hayden misled the White House, Congress, and the Director of national intelligence about the program's effectiveness. The CIA planted false stories in the press. It lied about the value of intelligence extracted from abused detainees. At least 26 of the 119 detainees held by the CIA were subsequently found to have been innocent. Many of them were tortured. Torture inflicted on detainees included force-feeding and hydrating prisoners anally and rectal examinations using excessive force, mock executions, and at least one instance of forcing a prisoner to play Russian roulette. Prisoners kept awake for a week, and one kept in a coffin-sized confinement box for 11 days, forcing a detainee to stand and stay awake for nearly 3 days. Prisoners denied waste buckets, kept short-shackled and naked in darkened cold cells with constant white noise. Prisoners slapped, punched, slammed against walls and cement floors. These were just the detainees held by the CIA. God have mercy on those the agency rendered to other countries. Evidence for all the above charges and more were found in communications the agency provided the committee voluntarily, and much of it was confirmed in a document the CIA accidentally provided and wished it hadn't, the report of an internal review ordered by Leon Panetta, whom President Obama had appointed Director of Central Intelligence. Panetta's successor, John Brennan, accused committee investigators of improperly assessing the Panetta review and removing it from the CIA, and had filed a criminal referral at Justice against lead investigator Dan Jones, a former FBI officer. It was an ass-covering feint. In truth, the agency had inadvertently included the Panetta review in a massive data dump to the committee, a tactic often used to hide embarrassing disclosures in a haystack of unimportant and dull information. When they realized the committee now possessed it, CIA personnel hacked the investigators' computers, an unlawful act and a violation of the separation of powers, which should have resulted in the firing of officials who had ordered it. I denounced the hacking as clearly unconstitutional and in some ways worse than criminal. There were references to me in some of the cables and emails committee investigators reviewed. One memo from the Office of Legal Counsel reported that DCI Hayden had briefed several members of Congress, including members of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and Senator McCain, on 6 of the enhanced interrogation techniques. None of the members expressed the view that the CIA interrogation program should be stopped or that the techniques at issue were inappropriate. A memo prepared by the CIA about the briefing contradicted that assertion, acknowledging that after the briefing, Senator John McCain informed the CIA that he believed the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques, including sleep deprivation and the waterboard, were torture. In another amusing exchange, one of the officers who had briefed me was asked by a colleague if I was on board. He replied, "Not totally." "If he's moved in our direction at all, you're a miracle worker. Was it painful?" "Very much so." "Is the issue the EITs still?" "Yep." The committee's investigation, in my opinion, was as professional as any I've observed by a congressional committee, and a credit to Dianne Feinstein's leadership. It was ably managed by Dan Jones, a fair-minded and conscientious seeker of the truth. I regretted the decision by most committee Republicans not to cooperate in the investigation and to publish their own dissenting report. Although many of them are friends of mine, I fear their actions were a product of an ill-conceived priority to protect CIA officials from repercussions for their breach of core American values and not a sincere effort to find the truth. Senior officials in the Obama administration who opposed the release of the report, including, among others, the White House Chief of Staff and Secretary of State, shared the same mistaken purpose. As chairman of the Armed Services Committee, I am an ex officio member of the Intelligence Committee. As an ex officio member, I do not have a vote in the committee's decisions. But before the vote to approve the report, I sent a letter to every member of the committee urging their support for it. I joined Diane and committee Democrats as they resisted a 2-year campaign by the Obama administration to prevent publication of an unclassified version of the report, and in pitched battles over unnecessary redactions they insisted on making to it. No protest from the agency, the White House, or Republicans was complete without the dark warning that we would have blood on our hands if we went through with publishing the report, as it would result in the death of Americans. Undaunted, on December 9, 2014, the committee released the unclassified report to the American public. Many of my Republican colleagues denounced it as a partisan smear. Former DCIs Tenet, Goss, and Hayden did the same in an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal. DCI Brennan disagreed with some of the committee's conclusions. Dick Cheney called it hooey. And any number of hard-charging Washington tough guys repeated the same old false claims for efficacy of waterboarding and all the other abuses the report had so thoroughly discredited. I spoke on the Senate floor in support of the report's release. I believe the American people have a right, I contended. Indeed, a responsibility to know what is done in their name, how these practices did or did not serve our interests, and how they comported with our most important values. The truth is sometimes a hard pill to swallow. It sometimes causes us difficulties at home and abroad. It is sometimes used by our enemies in attempts to hurt us, but the American people are entitled to it nonetheless. I ended my remarks by calling on all Americans to live our nation's ideals, to remember that we are always Americans and different, stronger, and better than those who would destroy us. In the following presidential campaign season that was soon to begin, the eventual Republican nominee and next president of the United States insisted torture absolutely works and swore he would bring back waterboarding and worse. His statement was made out of ignorance, attributable to his lack of experience in a role related to the defense of this country. It also exposed his apparent lack of appreciation for the importance of our values to our security, and for the understanding that simple human decency is as essential to the souls of nations as it is to the souls of people. There isn't anything he can do about it, though. Dianne Feinstein and I offered an amendment to the defense bill in 2015 that mandated the CIA and all government agencies abide by the restrictions in the Army Field Manual in their interrogation of any detainee. President Trump would need congressional approval to resort to these techniques again, and I'm confident enough members of Congress shamed by the abuses of the last decade would refuse. One critic of the committee's report wrote in a column for the Washington Post that the Democrats had lost the torture debate because public polling showed that despite all the negative publicity about enhanced interrogation techniques, a majority of Americans still supported them. Democrats had failed to make the case that they were ineffective, unwarranted, and immoral, he argued. You can fail to tell the truth, but the truth cannot be a failure even if it's ignored or rejected. The report told the truth, and those who claim it did not are not telling the truth any more than they did when the practices were in use. They didn't tell the truth to the American people then, and they are not telling the truth to the American people now. They didn't tell the truth to the most senior officials in the government they served in. They didn't tell the truth to themselves. But the truth, or at least the closest, most thorough approximation of it, that can be discovered and assembled in a coherent fashion at this time, exists in the classified and unclassified Senate Intelligence Committee's report, despite all the delays, all the attempts at obfuscation, all the unnecessary redactions, all the false claims by people who felt the truth was a threat to them. It exists and is accessible to the American people. Some Americans might not believe it. Some might read it and forget it. Some might not care that we tortured people, but their moral failure isn't the truth's failure. The moral values and integrity of our nation and the long, difficult, fraught history of our efforts to uphold them at home and abroad are the test of every American generation. Will we act in this world with respect for our founding conviction that all people have equal dignity in the eyes of God and should be accorded the same respect by the laws and governments of men? That is the most important question history ever asks of us. Answering in the affirmative by our actions is the highest form of patriotism, and we cannot do that without access to the truth. The cruelty of our enemies doesn't absolve us of this duty. This was never about them. It was about us. Chapter 4. In the Company of Heroes. I made my first trip to Afghanistan in January 2002. We were the first congressional delegation to travel there since the start of Operation Enduring Freedom 3 months earlier. There were 9 of us, including some of my closest friends in the Senate at the time, Joe Lieberman, Chuck Hagel, Fred Thompson, and Susan Collins. We had spent the day in Tajikistan, waiting for dark, and a specially equipped C-130 that normally ferried special forces and their supplies. I was anxious to go. I doubt the U.S. military command in Afghanistan was excited to see us. Kabul had fallen in November and Kandahar in December. The Battle of Tora Bora had been fought only a few weeks earlier. While many Taliban and Al-Qaeda had fled to Pakistan, there was still hard fighting in the south, and large swaths of the country were mostly ungoverned and very dangerous. We were likely considered a distraction and a security headache. British Prime Minister Tony Blair was scheduled to make a visit the same day, complicating the situation. We weren't allowed to spend the night and would be in country for 6 hours or less. We boarded the C-130 accompanied by a guy dressed in black and a suitcase handcuffed to his wrist containing $10,000 in cash to pay for our fuel. Evidently, Bagram Airfield didn't take plastic. We flew without lights, with only glow sticks for illumination. Our pilots, fearing we would be fired at as we approached, took evasive measures. We arrived at Bagram at midnight. As we disembarked, we were warned not to wander off the tarmac, as the surrounding ground was mined. We drove through the ramshackle base in a Humvee as men with long beards dressed as Mujahideen and carrying arms observed us. They looked threatening. "Who are they?" my foreign policy aide, Dan Twining, asked. "They're our guys," someone replied. "Special forces." We were taken to a tent, seated on sandbags, and briefed on the war's progress and the coalition's effort to help set up a functioning national authority. Hamid Karzai was brought in to meet with us. An Afghan assembly representing all districts in the country, Aloya Jirga, would select him as president of a transitional government in June. He hadn't a title when we met him that first time, but he was clearly the U.S. and Britain's preferred choice for the national government's leader. He made an impression that night in his robes, captivating manner, and idiomatic English. I got along well with him and continued to get along with him in the years to come, though he would prove to be a corrupt and insecure leader and difficult to deal with. That night he seemed the right man for the job, and we talked at length about his vision of a modern democratic Afghanistan before Karzai had to leave to meet with the just-arrived Tony Blair. It was a fascinating discussion, and meeting like that under a tent in the desert night was evocative, to say the least. We met briefly with Blair, too, before we departed for Pakistan in the early morning, all of us, fairly optimistic that coalition authorities and enlightened Afghans had a decent shot to pacify the turbulent country once known as the graveyard of empires and rid the world of one of the most inhumane regimes on earth. On my next trip to Afghanistan, I went with Twining to Bamiyan to see the ruins of the 1,000-year-old Buddhist statues destroyed by the Taliban. Quite a metaphor for Taliban rule, I thought. The statues had survived Genghis Khan and the Mongol horde and the Soviet invasion, but not this crew of annihilating fanatics. We paid a visit to the carrier USS Theodore Roosevelt on station in the Arabian Sea after that first visit to Afghanistan. Responding to the enthusiasm of a gung-ho crowd of sailors and aviators, I said something I later regretted. "Next up, Baghdad," I shouted, and was cheered. I was an advocate for invading Iraq, not because I believed that Saddam Hussein like the Taliban in Afghanistan was harboring al-Qaeda, but because I believed the U.S. intelligence community assessment that he had weapons of mass destruction, which he had proven willing to use in the past. He had refused to allow U.N. inspectors the access necessary to ascertain whether or not he had them. He was also as brutal a tyrant as any who lived, guilty of numerous atrocities, some of which he had committed when he believed the United States would not react. He routinely ordered his air defenses to shoot at U.S. overflights of Iraq. I also believed the overthrow of his regime and the establishment of an Arab democracy would strike as great a blow as any force of arms against extremism and despotism in the Middle East. But the principal reason for invading Iraq that Saddam had WMD was wrong. The war, with its cost in lives and treasure and security, can't be judged as anything other than a mistake, a very serious one, and I have to accept my share of the blame for it. None of that was known, of course, that day in the Roosevelt, when I was firm in my convictions and self-assured. Even if we had been right about Saddam's weapons program, I shouldn't have used the occasion to cheer the prospect of war. All wars are awful. My exclamation would have been appropriate had I been an officer rallying troops to arms. But I wasn't. I was a politician, and I had other responsibilities, one of which was to make certain there was a valid purpose for ordering Americans into harm's way, and an achievable mission. This isn't to say that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein's atrocious regime and the effort to replace it with a rudimentary democracy wasn't a just cause. It was, and the hundreds of thousands of Americans who have risked their lives to achieve those ends are owed the eternal gratitude of Iraqis and Americans for the sacrifices they made for people who were strangers to them. But for all the justice they served, for all their courage and professionalism and endurance, they wouldn't have been asked to make such sacrifices if we hadn't believed Saddam had WMD. But we did, and we sent them to war in Iraq. Every public official involved in that decision has to accept responsibility for it. And we also had to accept responsibility for making sure that, mistake or not, the sacrifices made by Americans in that conflict wouldn't end in our defeat. Unlike my initial visit to Afghanistan, my first trip to Iraq didn't leave me optimistic about our prospects for success. On the contrary, I thought we were heading in a direction that would almost certainly result in failure. It was August 2003, a few months after President Bush had announced on the USS Abraham Lincoln that major combat operations in Iraq were over. He never said mission accomplished. That unfortunate declaration was printed on a banner hung in the background by the ship's crew, and he acknowledged that there was still fighting ahead in Iraq. But the event gave Americans the impression that we were just mopping up in Iraq, that our effort there was nearing a conclusion. It fit with the theory advanced by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld that the armed resistance coalition forces were still encountering amounted only to a few dead-enders. That was a very mistaken point of view, which was quite evident in August 2003. We were a large bicameral delegation and on the ground for only 36 hours in total. My Arizona colleague Jim Colby was there, as was Lindsey Graham, a newly elected senator then. As in Afghanistan, we couldn't remain in the country overnight. We made stops in Baghdad, Kirkuk in the north, and Basra in the south, and returned to Kuwait City at the end of each day. We met with Coalition Provisional Authority CPA Administrator Paul Bremer, who a few months before had dissolved the Iraqi army and banned Baathists from serving in military or government positions. Even teachers who had to register with the Baathist Party in order to work lost their jobs. Hundreds of thousands of armed and angry Sunni men had a lot of time on their hands and scores to settle. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez was commanding coalition forces then and was rumored to have opposed Bremer's debathification policy, as had most field commanders in Iraq, believing correctly that it was a primary cause of the incipient Sunni insurgency that had started causing trouble in the Sunni Triangle and elsewhere and would ally with terrorist groups. We were meeting with Bremer and Walt Slocum, a well-regarded senior Defense Department official, when Sunni jihadists struck their first hard blow. A suicide bomber enlisted by Jordanian terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and his al-Qaeda affiliate, al-Qaeda in Iraq, drove a truck bomb next to the Canal Hotel and detonated it. The blast could be felt a mile away. We heard a thud, and a minute later an aide handed Bremer a note. He glanced at it, apologized, and cut short our meeting. The Canal Hotel housed the headquarters for the United Nations mission in Iraq, which was led by one of the UN's most accomplished diplomats, Sergio Vieira de Mello, who died in the blast along with 21 other UN staff and international and Iraqi aid workers. A second bombing in September would result in the UN effectively shutting down its Iraq mission, leaving the U.S. and its allies with even more responsibilities to rebuild the shattered country while it dealt with the spreading insurgency. Security precautions in Baghdad were less restrictive in subsequent visits than they were on that initial one, but then got worse with each passing year. I've made over 20 trips to Iraq and Afghanistan. In 2004, we could have dinner in a Baghdad restaurant and walk unmolested at night back to the Al-Rashid Hotel. We moved around the city in SUVs. If we had a little spare time, we could poke around in the local markets. 2 years later, our plane touched down after a corkscrew landing to avoid missiles. We traveled in armored vehicles through deserted streets. We're mostly confined to the Green Zone, the heavily protected government district in central Baghdad, and wore Kevlar vests if we were going to spend even a few minutes in a public space. Something else I noticed, too, even on that first trip. Iraq was a grimmer, more oppressive place than Afghanistan, where we had stopped before coming to Iraq. It didn't feel liberated from tyranny so much as hung over from the experience, whereas with Afghans, you generally had the sense that they were relieved to be out from under the Taliban. Afghans also appeared more disarming and open, whatever ulterior motives they might possess. Most Iraqis we met in an official capacity or in public encounters appeared reticent and suspicious, even angry. You never felt anyone trusted anyone else. Things were different in the north with the Kurds, who were more engaging and cooperative, and where I've managed to cultivate more than a few trusting relationships. But meetings in Baghdad and elsewhere with Shia or Sunnis could be dour affairs, and it was hard to get a sense of whom to trust. The most impactful meeting I had on that first visit, the meeting that convinced me our strategy in Iraq was the opposite of what we needed there, was a briefing we received from British soldiers in Basra. Basra should have been friendly country for the U.S. and British liberating forces. This wasn't the disenfranchised Sunni triangle. It was our part of Iraq, the Shia South, oppressed and terrorized by Saddam and the Sunni minority, people who had longed for Saddam's overthrow. It was a mess. Local government was completely ineffectual. Lawlessness was rampant. It was hotter than hell and water was scarce. There were frequent power outages. The sewage system wasn't working. Canal beds were dry and filled with uncollected garbage. The Brits, who had authority over the place, were headquartered in a heavily barricaded base, but they would go out every day and engage the Shia population wearing berets and no body armor. Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shia militia leader, was starting to mobilize and had already denounced the CPA in Baghdad as imperialists. Although he wasn't yet as powerful as he aspired to be, he had figured out that the way to win friends and influence people was to inveigh against Western imperialists. In Basra and throughout the South, the Shia population wasn't in rebellion against the occupiers yet, but things were heading in that direction. The British had a long history with Iraq, having occupied the country a century earlier. The British officers posted in Basra in the summer of 2003 had a sense of history and an acute appreciation for local attitudes and the broader challenges facing the coalition. One of them, a no-nonsense colonel, whose name I wish I could remember, took it upon himself to give us the unvarnished truth about our situation as he saw it. They met with us at the local airfield that had been built by the Germans. After introductions were made, the British colonel got down to business, prefacing his briefing by declaring, "I'm going to tell you the truth," and his tone and demeanor instantly conveyed the impression that the truth was going to be distressing. No one with stars on their shoulders